This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Are Katrina victims forgotten already? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To The Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Barely 3 months ago, President Bush promised one of the largest reconstruction efforts the world has ever seen. But after a $62 billion recovery pledge, the White House and Congress seem to be having second thoughts. On To The Point, can private enterprise rebuild New Orleans alone? Will residents and businesses return without the long-term support that only the federal government can provide? Is the rest of the nation committed to bailing out the Big Easy? On Reporter's Notebook later on, more trouble for Merck in the aftermath of pulling Vioxx off the market. First, here's the news.
Support for To The Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To The Point. Despite the massive assistance promised in the aftermath of Katrina, victims are worried that they've been forgotten by the White House and Congress. On To The Point, we'll hear what it's like to try to rebuild as Washington has second thoughts. On Reporter's Notebook, Merck faces 6,500 suits over Vioxx, the painkiller it pulled off the market. We'll hear about other challenges facing the world's fifth largest pharmaceutical company. First, this news update. Despite the increasing federal deficit, Congress yesterday completed the passage of $56 billion in tax cuts, focusing on stock dividends and capital gains. That's a far cry from what passed the Senate, and there is little time to reconcile their different versions before the end of the year. Jody Schneider is economics editor of Congressional Quarterly. Jody, thanks a lot for joining us.
Good afternoon.
How is it that the Senate version differs from the House? What are the main points of difference?
Well, the House bill that was passed this week, as you said, is $56.1 billion in tax cuts. It basically includes something that the Senate bill does not. It is an extension of the capital gains and dividends tax break for 2 years. That is not in the Senate bill. And that's the main difference, and it's going to be the tough one to reconcile next week with only a week left before they're supposed to go home for the holidays.
Republicans in charge of both houses, what is it about the Senate Republicans that makes them less likely to include the tax cuts on capital gains and dividends?
Well, they would have liked to have. They had a problem in Olympia Snow, a Republican from Maine, who sits on the Senate Finance Committee, and she held up the action on it. They actually were not able to hold their panel meeting, their panel markup of the bill, because she would not vote for it with the capital gains and dividends tax extension in there, and they needed her. They had no Democratic vote, so they needed her. They then were able to pass it on the floor without it. What they did is sort of wink, wink, nod, nod, saying, well, we'll get it back in conference. It's in the House bill. They'll pass it that way, and we'll get it back in conference. Now comes the conference.
Once again, as we are learning so often now, as the session comes to an end, once bills have been passed in different forms by each house, there's then a conference committee involving members of both houses. And when it comes out of there, you can only vote up or down on it, right? You can't amend it.
Right. Once it comes out of the conference, it's just an up or down vote. Correct.
A little earlier this week, we heard about the defense bill with the 2,000 earmarkings in there, many of which were put in the conference committee. Is that sort of thing likely to happen with the tax bill? Will there be stuff inserted into it that wasn't really debated on the floor of either house?
I don't believe so in this bill. They pretty much got what they wanted here. They're going to be on the appropriations bill, the last bill out of town, as we say, the defense bill, will certainly be a measure for carrying those hitchhikers, as we call them, in appropriations. We think they pretty much have what they want here. The real question is, can they decide on this issue of whether the capital gains and dividends tax break goes into this one? Can they get it through? And do they have enough time? Because they could do these next year, too.
Jody Schneider, again, is economics editor with Congressional Quarterly. Let me ask you this. Certainly the members of Congress look at the polls. There's a Harris poll recently that says this. 75% of people believe that the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. That's up from 68% last year. 53% say the people running the country don't really care what happens to you. How do Republicans, particularly who are pushing for such things as tax breaks on capital gains and dividends, reconcile what they're doing with what appears to be public opinion?
Well, that's an interesting question. First of all, I think they are thinking more about that. For instance, before they went ahead and took this vote, before they scheduled this vote on the with the capital gains tax break in this reconciliation bill, they went ahead and did a few other tax cuts that they thought the public wanted more. One was to basically reduce the number of middle-class people who were subject to the alternative minimum tax. They did that just one day before they passed the big tax cut, and they also passed some hurricane tax breaks, some Gulf Coast tax incentives. So it's sort of saying tax cuts cut both ways, if you will, and they were able to both get moderates in the House who may not have voted for this big tax package without having first voted for those more seemingly generous to the middle class and the hurting tax packages. On the other hand, I think they, the Republican leadership believes that in the long run, even though people may not say that they want tax cuts, that they don't want the rich to get them, certainly, but that when they get them, they like them and they like to keep them.
There's also the argument by some Congress members that tax relief is part of the deficit solution because it leads to economic growth, more jobs. That means more tax revenue. Does that argument hold a lot of sway? And do Democrats even sometimes, at least, get on board that one?
Yeah, it's an argument they like to make on the Hill. Republicans like to make. The White House continues to make it. They keep saying that the economy is strong partly because of their tax breaks. Frankly, there's not a lot of economic evidence to show that that's the case, but you can't necessarily show it's not the case either. So that argument will continue to be made on the Hill and by the administration. The Democrats have used the line of, we don't want tax breaks for the rich. They realize that the middle class likes their tax breaks, you know, as well as anyone, and so they haven't been able to effectively come out against middle class tax breaks. Their line has been people making $200,000 a year and more shouldn't get them. So, and I think they will stick with that. They will try to use this vote in the House against Republicans running in tough races next year.
All right. We will see if they manage to reconcile their two versions of the tax cuts before the end of the year, and if not, what happens next year. Jody Schneider, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
Economics editor, Congressional Quarterly. Again, hurricane tax breaks, a part of the package. We'll be talking about the hurricane and Katrina victims who think they've been forgotten in Washington in just a moment on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Well, we're only back with To the Point. James O'Byrne is editor of the Living section of the New Orleans Times-Picayune. In the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, he's been shaping news coverage of the recovery. He is especially well-qualified for that assignment because he is one of the people who lost his own home. James O'Byrne, welcome to our program.
Thank you.
Let's first talk about your own situation, and then we will extrapolate to what's happening to everybody else, something that you're in a position to know as editor of the Living section. What has it been like for you to try to take advantage of what's been offered, or at least we are told has been offered in the way of recovery aid?
Well, we have a motto here in New Orleans, those of us who have who've been hit by the storm, and that's everything is hard. And it's quite frankly a constant struggle and a constant tremendous amount of work to try to wend your way through this maze of bureaucracy and grant and insurance and all the other things that you have to contend with when your house is destroyed, and then find a place to live, and then you have to deal with the expenses of constantly having to move around. You have to contend with paying your rent. And come January, for most people, the mortgage companies are going to be expecting, including my mortgage company, are going to be expecting us to start resuming paying mortgages on houses that are still completely uninhabitable and neighborhoods that are still completely uninhabitable as well. It's a strange town to be in right now. And the thing that drives us crazy, most of us, is when our friends or relatives call and say things must be getting back to normal. But today I'm really not much closer 3 months after the storm to beginning to rebuild my house than I was the day it flooded.
How much of a rebuild do you need?
Well, in my particular neighborhood, which is close to the breach of the 17th Street Canal in New Orleans, most of the single story homes in that neighborhood took on anywhere from 5 to 9 feet of water, and that water stayed there for 3 weeks. So in many of those cases, those homes are cheaper to tear down and start over than they are to rehab in place. Some of the larger two-story homes in the neighborhood can be renovated, but they have substantial damage as well.
That's your own situation? You're going to tear your place down?
My own situation, I'm going to tear my place down and rebuild, assuming I can put together the funds to rebuild.
What happens then in terms of the finances? Do you then try to renegotiate with the mortgage company a new loan for the new house?
What the mortgage company will do is they will hold on to your insurance settlement as a rebuilding fund, if that's the route you choose to go.
Mm-hmm.
And then they will disperse that as you rebuild. One of the conditions that you face here is that what they regarded as the fair market replacement value of a house in New Orleans before the storm, given that, more than 100,000 houses are destroyed, is really not nearly enough to rebuild a house, and certainly not enough to build a house higher if you either choose to go higher or if the federal flood insurance regulations mandate that you go higher, as will be the case in my case.
Well, as far as reconstruction is concerned, how much assurance do you have that the same thing isn't going to happen again to the new house once it's rebuilt?
Well, therein lies the big problem and one of the reasons why New Orleanians are increasingly frustrated and angry, and that we understand something about this disaster that a lot of people around the country don't understand, and that it is in large measure a man-made disaster. New Orleans is surrounded by a series of flood walls and levees that were specifically supposed to hold up to a storm even of this magnitude. And what we have found in our reporting is that, and it's being echoed in studies by the National Science Foundation and the American Society of Engineers, is that the design of these seawalls was deeply flawed and their construction was completely inadequate. And the federal government, through the Army Corps of Engineers, is the one who built those seawalls. And when they were asked to simply perform the function they were designed to perform, to hold in the water, they failed catastrophically. And you have more than 1,200 people dead in our metropolitan area, and 500,000 people are displaced, and about 150,000 housing units are damaged or destroyed. And what we're looking for, basically, is some statement from the federal government, some acknowledgement from the federal government of their culpability and responsibility in what happened here. Because if absent those seawalls collapsing, my home would be fine and I would be living in it today, as would tens of thousands of New Orleanians be living in their homes today. So that is the absolute commitment to build levees and seawalls that actually work as they were designed to do and that will protect us from this happening again is kind of what everyone is waiting for from the federal government.
James O'Byrne, again, editor of the Living section of the Times-Picayune in New Orleans, and also one of those who lost his house. So I should point out that Mayor Nagin today at the National League of Cities in Charlotte said that he thinks what's happening in Washington is that the White House and Congress are so focused now on Iraq and other such things that their actions are actually discouraging the reconstruction of Iraq. On that note, let me go to Bruce Katz, who's vice president of the Brookings Institution and director of its Metropolitan Policy Program. And Bruce Katz, thank you for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
What's happened 3 months after the president said he'll do anything that it takes, everything that it takes, I should say, to rebuild New Orleans?
I think what you've had, both with the administration and with the Congress, is a failure of leadership, a failure of vision, a failure of consistency, both with regard to the emergency response, the displacement of renters and homeowners, the devastation of the housing market, and with regard to the longer-term rebuild. And to some extent, we're still in the middle of the emergency response, which is really quite remarkable. Yesterday, a senior person at FEMA finally acknowledged, after 3 months of criticism, that FEMA made the wrong call when it decided to respond to the displacement of hundreds of thousands of people with trailers and emergency hotels and motels and even cruise ships as literally the vehicle for relocating people. And this was in the face of a lot of information that FEMA and HUD and others and the administration had about how to do this right, how to quickly move tens of thousands of people to quality, stable housing for an indeterminate, perhaps 15 to 18 month period of time. So some of the response has been just a failure to acknowledge what worked in past disasters and to apply that information to Katrina, and to do so with vigor and competency. And the other failure, obviously, is with the longer-term rebuild. There's a lack of certainty. There's a lack of predictability. There's a lack of focus on what the federal government needs to do with regard to the levies, with regard to flood insurance, with regard to housing investments and economic development investments. So you create a climate for business recovery and investment itself. So I think just threaded throughout here is just a failure both with regard to the short and long term, with regard to the micro and the macro. It's a fundamental breaking down of the federal government. Some of it's ideological, some of it's political, some of it's just the failure to focus on keeping these agencies capable and responsible.
We've heard before what James O. Byrne said so very dramatically and eloquently a moment ago, that a lot of people feel that the federal government was responsible for the disaster in the first place because of the inadequate designs of the safety walls and the canals and all the rest of the flood protection. Wasn't that recognized initially by the Congress and by the president? Have they forgotten about that, or what happened to the sense that the federal government had a real responsibility here?
Well, it goes beyond the seawalls, to be frank. I mean, you know, most of New Orleans that was affected were these enclaves of poverty, the lower Ninth Ward and so forth. And many of those neighborhoods were sort of built and paid for by the federal government over a long period of time, public housing, other assisted housing. So to some extent, I think he's right. The federal government broke it in a way, and they really have more responsibility in New Orleans to fix it. And to provide the kind of capital and predictability necessary to get the market moving again. What has happened, I mean, obviously the president is in a weakened political state. The House fiscal conservatives are in revolt. I just don't think the president has the ability to sort of stand by his statements on September 15th when he really laid out a fairly bold and ambitious plan for rebuilding. I think there's a lot of political risk for the administration and Congress in not pursuing what the president promised and committed to 3 months ago.
Where's the political risk? Does it come from the rest of the country? Do you think other people around the nation are eager to come up with money to try to bail out the people in New Orleans? And in we haven't talked, of course, we're focusing on New Orleans, but of course there's the rest of Louisiana and Mississippi and Alabama as well.
I think the political risk is that a good portion of the country was willing to sign on to the rebuild in mid-September. The president, I think, made a series of commitments that I think the rest of the country, or a good portion of them, would be willing to support. The real risk here, to be frank, is that the media, and this show is just indicative of it, the media continues to cover the response to Katrina with a level of intensity that we rarely see in domestic life. And therefore, they are holding the administration, they are holding Congress accountable for one particular issue and set of issues in ways that they normally don't do. And I think that's the risk. I think a good portion of this country understands that they are vulnerable to natural disasters, to man-made disasters, to terrorist attacks. And I think the failure of the federal government to have leadership, vision, and competence in the aftermath of Katrina is very, very troubling to the public at large. And so this is not an issue that's going to go away. We're going to be back at this in February in the budget. We're going to be back at this in next May when many of these supplemental appropriations are going to run out. We're going to be back at this when the midterms start emerging in September. Midterm elections start gaining national prominence in next September, October, and November.
Again, Bruce Katz is vice president of the Brookings Institution, directs the Metropolitan Policy Program at that think tank in Washington. Let me go back to James O. Byrne, editor of the Living Section at the Times-Picayune. Do you still see the ongoing national coverage that was so pervasive in the immediate aftermath of the disaster?
Well, we see it picking up a bit after quite a lull for a while. We wondered if the nation and the media had the attention span it took to cover a story of this magnitude, because it's a strange town to be in. And then if you come to New Orleans right now, and I keep you on what we call the island, the part of the city, the French Quarter, and parts of Uptown and the Garden District, and we can go to some fine restaurants and we can tour around the city, and we can never really see the vast swaths of destruction that lie just really, literally less than a mile beyond the
borders of those areas. So for a long time, the stories focused on those kind, the zoo reopening, those kinds of things, like things were getting back to normal. I think that's why people keep asking us things are getting back to normal. But I see now that that's changing a little bit, that one of the things that happens is when people come to see the city and drive for 2 hours and never see a habitable house, they start to understand the magnitude of
it. You drive for 2 hours and you don't see a habitable house?
I can take you on a drive through city streets north of the French Quarter all the way to the lake, and then we can turn east and drive all the way to eastern New Orleans, and then we can turn south and drive all the way to St. Bernard Parish, and then we can turn back west and drive through the Ninth Ward. You will not see a house that didn't sustain major damage from the storm. The magnitude of this is very difficult, if not impossible, to conceive until you see it. The city is laid waste right now beyond the island. And so we're starting to see people grasp that. Some media outlets have grasped it from the very beginning. Others are starting to realize that this is far from over for us. It is still, as Mr. Katz said, an emergency here for us.
James L. Byrne with the Times-Picayune. Back to Bruce Katz at the Brookings Institution. What about the $62 billion that the president pushed through the Congress in the immediate aftermath? What's happening to that money? Is it enough, or will it be enough, ultimately, to provide the kind of reconstruction that you seem to think the federal government is responsible to provide?
Well, most of that funding is going towards emergency assistance for displaced renters and homeowners, and for infrastructure repair, and to some extent, very small extent, environmental cleanup. But we've only spent about half of that funding to date. That's not totally surprising. But I think what is surprising is we've spent a good portion of that money on the wrong things. Again, what the administration decided to do in the aftermath of Katrina was to choose a series of relocation tools, trailers, motels, hotels, et cetera, that are really inefficient, fiscally costly. They've been administered in an incredibly haphazard way. What they didn't do was to use tried and true proven programs like housing vouchers out of HUD, which in the aftermath of Northridge were shown to really help people relocate to private quality stable housing very, very quickly, aided and abetted by local agencies.
Northridge, of course, the earthquake in California
1994.
In 1994. Right.
So we spent about half of this money, but to be frank, we spent a good portion of the funding to date with misguided programs, with ineffective programs, in a very non-imaginative, less than creative way. I mean, this was a disaster where the president could have held a summit at the White House in the middle of September. We have the most sophisticated housing development and finance system in the world, and he basically could have called on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and major financial institutions and major developers in collaboration with local and regional entities to really put their shoulder behind this rebuild and behind the emergency response. There has just been an incredible lack of leadership and creativity at the national level, and we are wasting money in the emergency response, not because of the inefficiency, I believe, of local government, but because the federal government chose the wrong way of responding.
Bruce Katz, Vice President of the Brookings Institution, Director of the Metropolitan Policy Program. We're going to continue this conversation. I should say we asked the White House and we asked FEMA to participate in our conversation today. They declined our invitation. On Reporter's Notebook, the aftermath of disaster with Vioxx. What's in store for Merck? Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warman, I'll be back with To the Point. Talk today not so much about the massive reconstruction of in the aftermath of Katrina, promised by the president about 3 months ago, but about what our earlier guests have described as the ongoing emergency. Given the extent of the damage, the responsibility of the federal government, and according to Bruce Katz of the Brookings Institution, the lack of leadership in Washington to do anything about it. Before we move on to our next guest, which I want to do, let me go back to James O'Byrne with the Times-Picayune. Earlier, Bruce Katz mentioned that the second-ranking disaster official in Louisiana has now criticized FEMA for the way in which the housing program was laid out, using the trailers and the hotel rooms and all the other things that we heard about. And the second paragraph in the Washington Post on that story today says this, that instead of spending $140,000 for each trailer and site for a family to use for 18 months, The government should hand out a lump sum of $26,000 that Congress has approved for storm victims. Does that make any sense? Certainly a way to save money, but would that solve the need?
Well, there's two angles to this, and I'll speak from my own experience. In the immediate near term, the rental assistance offered by the government in whatever form it's offered is sort of essential to make ends meet and be able to find a place to live while you're dealing with the incredible expenses that come from a disaster like this. A FEMA trailer for me is only practical if it allows you to live on your property while you rebuild your land rather than in vast trailer parks. But for the rest of the city, housing is a critical issue, and housing within the metro area is a critical issue because a vast number of people have been displaced, and in large measure, many of those people don't have the means to get back. So you have, you know, I can take you to Emeralds or Clancy's to go out to eat. We can't go to Wendy's or McDonald's because there's no working class in the city. The hotels in the city are open for business, and the rooms are clean, but you can't get room service because they don't have enough employees. So the housing crisis, it's not just a matter of finding people places to live where they are, but in somehow for the city to get back, there has to be places for people to live that are closer into the city so that they can actually work in the city and start helping to rebuild the city. Right now, the city itself vacates every evening because there's not enough livable housing units in the city for people to live.
Ask one question, and the answer suggests dozens more. That's how complicated this situation is. Bruce Katz of the Brookings Institution, what about people who didn't have insurance, which is a substantial number of people in this area? Should they be made whole in some way or supported by the federal government?
Well, the question is whether they're supported directly or whether they can be supported through the catalyzing the housing market in New Orleans and the metro area and the Gulf Coast. I mean, I have said, and others
have
said...
What does catalyzing mean?
Well, I think what the federal government needs to put on the table are tax credits to stimulate the construction of both rental housing and ownership housing, particularly for those people who are displaced by the storm who did not have insurance. And we've had a rental housing tax credit in the United States since 1986. It is incredibly effective. It is incredibly cost efficient. Yet it's the one thing that the administration has really not called for. What they're calling for is a fairly small and micro program called urban homesteading, where they would turn over a couple thousand parcels of land, principally to low-income families who would then work with local churches to rebuild housing, sort of a Habitat for Humanity response. I think that's fine, but we've seen a 250,000 housing units destroyed by this storm and hundreds of thousands of people displaced. So turning over a couple thousand parcels of land, it just does not meet the scale and the magnitude of this disaster and does not build upon tried and proven programs that have been in place in the United States since the 1980s. So I think the federal government really has to basically provide the resources and the regulatory certainty and predictability to catalyze the rejuvenation of the market in New Orleans and the metropolitan area. They just don't seem to get it, to be frank. And I think at this stage, the only thing that's going to really turn this around is the kind of media coverage and the kind of citizenry response, not just in the area, but in the rest of the country, over the course of the next 6 to 9 months.
Bruce Katz, again, Vice President of the Brookings Institution. Robert Hartwig is Chief Economist at the Insurance Information Institute. Mr. Hartwig, you've been waiting patiently, listening to our program, and thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me here.
You have raised the question, particularly with regard to people who don't or didn't have insurance before this disaster, about whether or not people around the country really do, in fact, want to contribute to their to subsidizing them as the city tries to reconstruct itself. What's your point? What are you concerned about?
Well, a couple of things here. Obviously, in the insurance world, I will tell you that Hurricane Katrina is the most expensive disaster, not only in U.S. history, but in world history. The single event, Katrina alone, will cost insurers about $40 billion, and that's a conservative estimate. It could range up to $60 billion. Across 1.6 million claims. Now, One of the greatest tragedies associated with this event, obviously it was a terrible human tragedy, but part of the reason why it is so difficult for New Orleans and parts of coastal Mississippi to get back on their feet is the fact that there was not enough insurance coverage, and in many cases, no insurance coverage purchased by many people in these areas. And this was principally the result of the fact that flood coverage was not as widely purchased as it should have been. There are, depending on what part of New Orleans we're talking about, up to 60% in some areas, but as we get away from New Orleans, as few as 10% of the structures in these areas actually had flood coverage. The same thing goes for coastal Mississippi, where only about 1 in 6 homes in the coastal communities even had flood coverage. Even people within sight of the Gulf itself did not have flood coverage. And now the point is that flood coverage is available from the National Flood Insurance Program. It has been for 37 years. It's available at relatively nominal cost. By that I mean it's sold below what could be offered in the private sector. And individuals who purchase flood coverage, in fact, will be able to, in large part, rebuild either in New Orleans or it's their prerogative to rebuild, take the money and rebuild someplace else. The question that's being raised right now is, should individuals, particularly those who made a conscious decision not to purchase types of coverage that you think should be purchased in areas that have been known to flood in the past, should there be basically a realization, if you will, that not a realization, but maybe should we be establishing a pattern that these claims should be paid today, perhaps 5 years again, 5 years from now, again, 10 years after that? And this is a serious problem within the flood insurance program, generally speaking. And so, people around the country, and I think this is some of what you're seeing, some of the resistance in Congress, some of the fiscal conservatives. If you poll people around the country, they're concerned that the tens or hundreds of billions of dollars going here are taking away from their programs. They're adding on to the federal deficit. It means higher taxes for their children and grandchildren. This is a situation that they feel is intolerable.
What about the responsibility of the federal government, as we heard it defined by our earlier guests, for having essentially created this disaster by failing to build flood control systems that were adequate to the requirement?
Right. Obviously, there's some culpability there on the part of the on the part of the federal government, but there was. It is also the fact that it was known that these levees would not withstand anything greater than a Category 3. I think that's a fairly common knowledge. Certainly, there were studies that had been done before Katrina that revealed this issue. The question is. And not just in Florida. We don't look at this as just a New Orleans-type issue. We look at this as an issue that crops up around the country. Florida knows it's vulnerable. Mississippi knows it's vulnerable. South Carolina knows it's vulnerable. There are things that these states need to do now to prevent, or in the case of New Orleans, perhaps could have done, to lessen this, with or without the federal government. Let's face it, we now have basically an administration and a Congress that discusses concepts like the ownership society. We're talking about basically diminishing the value of Social Security and putting more emphasis on personal responsibility, even when it comes to retirement. I don't see what it is that leads us to believe that the government is going to, in the future, want to have a greater role in protecting us with levees, dams, and dikes. I just don't think that's where we're headed in Washington these days.
Well, let me ask you this. We heard the word certainty mentioned a moment ago. Isn't it true that if there isn't some degree of certainty that there's going to be flood protection in that area, that residents aren't going to return. Businesses aren't going to return. We just heard about the fact that there's no laboring class now left in New Orleans. Won't that mean that the whole region will become less desirable for investment by such institutions as your own industry, the insurance business?
Absolutely, it is. And it is quite possibly the case that if New Orleans is not rebuilt to withstand stronger storms in the future, then from an investment perspective, whether we're talking about private businesses or from the perspective of insurers who have to assume risk for businesses and homeowners who live in these areas, it does become less attractive. And at some point, it becomes uninsurable. If we have a fair degree of certainty that this event is going to recur sometime in the not-too-distant future, And there's absolutely every reason to believe, given the expectations for more frequent storms and more intense storms over the next 20 to 30 years, as all meteorologists agree, is likely. It becomes a very, very difficult situation from an insurance perspective. Now, the state of Louisiana very recently has approved some of the most stringent building codes in the country. For instance, requiring homes in the southern part of the state to be able to withstand 150-mile-an-hour winds. But in reality, in New Orleans, it's not wind that's the enemy, it's water. And if you cannot control the water, and we've heard some controversial analyses being discussed on shows like 60 Minutes, for example, which allege that New Orleans, in fact, going to sink below the waves. I mean, that there's nothing that you can do about it. So there needs to be a serious discussion about what parts of New Orleans, and it may not be all of New Orleans, can be salvaged and protected, and so that level of confidence and certainty can return.
Robert Hartwig, chief economist at the Insurance Information Institute. Let me go back first to James O'Byrne, again, editor of the Living Section at the Times-Picayune, and also somebody who lost his own home in this catastrophe. What do you say to what we're hearing from Bob Hartwig, that we really ought to take a long look at New Orleans?
Well, first off, I would say, you know, when we're talking about insurance, we're talking the vast majority of damage claims in New Orleans are flood claims that are under the federal flood insurance program, not held by private insurers. But there are also some inaccuracies in the way this is perceived by people. There are a lot of areas in New Orleans that were not considered in a flood zone. They were out of the flood zone and thus not required by banks nor institutions to carry flood insurance. And those homes flooded because those assumptions were based on the fact that based on a belief that the flood control system would work as designed. When the flood control system failed, those homes not required to have flood insurance flooded. So it's a little bit, I think it's a little bit harsh to say, well, those people didn't have insurance, so they're out of luck. When it comes to the question, should New Orleans be rebuilt? I mean, what will Los Angeles expect if Los Angeles is leveled by a major earthquake? Will they expect the federal government to say, well, look, it's just, you know, you're on a fault. The fault's not going away, so we're not going to reinvest in your city because the danger is too great. No, you take measures to protect American cities. You try to learn the lessons from the disasters that occurred, and you rebuild. That's, I think, the conversation about abandoning an American city is unprecedented in the history of natural and man-made disaster. I mean,
let me go back. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I have another guest I want to introduce before we run out of time. And let me give Bob Hartwig a chance to respond to that. What about it? Pretty harsh when the banks and the other lenders aren't requiring flood insurance to say that you ought to have known there was a problem. And what about the future in places like Los Angeles or others that are subject to natural disaster?
Right. I believe that there was a lot of misunderstanding about when there's a difference between flood coverage not being required. In fact, you know, if your home is paid off, you don't have to buy homeowners insurance either. But whether it's a prudent purchase or not, even if it's not required, I mean, it can be made if you live in a city protected by levees, the flood coverage purchase is probably a prudent purchase. But I understand that many people believe if it's not required, they will then interpret that they don't need it under any circumstances.
I said we had another guest to introduce, and let me do that now in the few moments we have remaining. And I want to thank Alex Fraser for being on our program as long as he has without being able to contribute. He's director of the Public Finance Ratings Group at Standard & Poor's. That's a credit rating agency. And Alex Fraser, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
What's happening to the credit rating of, let us say, first New Orleans, Louisiana, that particular area which we're focusing on today?
Well, if I could perhaps put a stamp on this conversation we've had, It's our outlook of developing on the city of New Orleans. Could get better, could get worse in terms of credit. When the hurricane came through, we put the city and the state on credit watch and have resolved all of those ratings within the last couple of weeks, putting many of the local credits into non-investment grade rating categories, and the state itself was downgraded from an A-plus to a single A.
And that makes it the lowest rating of any state in the country, is that right?
Tied with California.
What does that mean in terms of, well, it, just what does that mean? How would you explain that to people who don't understand the significance of a credit rating for a state?
Well, a credit rating is a gauge used by investors to make investment decisions on risk. And by the way, the state rating actually has a negative outlook at this point, given all of the uncertainties that we've all been talking about, the issue of the levies, the insurance, the housing crisis. And we haven't talked about tourism yet, but that's also been, you know, traditionally a big part of both the city and the state economies.
So a negative rating in the sense that there's no expectation at this point that things are going to get better. You said they could go either way.
Well, certainly for New Orleans, it could certainly get worse. The state has many more resources at its disposal. But overall, they just got through a budget session that had to cut $1 billion or adjust to $1 billion of revenue loss for this coming year. So there's a lot of work still to be done.
Well, what about the various alternatives to what's happening now that we have heard about? If there were, for example, a much more extensive federal commitment than we have seen so far, despite what the president promised, would that be the kind of thing that would raise the credit rating of the areas involved?
Potentially, but I think the economy is really driving our ratings at this point. And along with that, there has to be a decision made, and there are many, many decisions to be made about how exactly New Orleans will be reconstructed and how it will appear once that's completed. I mean, Tulane took a step just recently and cutting a number of programs, and that's perhaps an example of one of many steps that have to be taken by the various institutions and interests in New Orleans.
Tulane University, very much affected by the flooding, had a big cutback. That's what you're talking about.
Yes.
So it's too easy then to say that if the federal government puts enough money in there, then it'll be an easy assumption that businesses will move in, residents will come back, and the economy will get going?
I think so at this point.
What more will it take? I mean, at what point do you look at it and say, well, the negative is no longer applied and we're now going to recommend investment after all?
Oh, it's still investment grade. The state is still rated investment grade at an A.
You said a lot of institutions and localities, though, were non-investment grade.
Well, the city of New Orleans, its water and sewer system, the convention center and so forth.
Okay. Alex Fraser again with the Standard and Poor's. So back to Bruce Katz at the Brookings Institution. You're director of the Metropolitan Policy Program. Pretty significant if the state or the city isn't in a position to borrow money and if the credit rating is so low that people don't want to invest. What should happen?
Well, I think, again, I agree with some of the comments made. I mean, this is the reason why the federal government really needs to step in and create a climate for business investment and market rejuvenation, partly through tax spending, partly through regular spending, partly through regulatory and administrative action. And I think this is really just a question of trade-offs. I mean, the House of Representatives just passed a tax-cutting bill, sort of continuing the last 5 years, sort of focus on tax cuts as the principal way of stimulating the economy. Well, I mean, that's what really this debate is about. I mean, should we continue on the fiscal holiday we've had at the federal level, with tax cuts principally geared towards the wealthiest of Americans? Or should we as a nation commit not just to the reconstruction of New Orleans and the rebuilding of the Gulf Coast, but to a whole bunch of other domestic priorities that are not being addressed given the tax focus of this administration and this Congress?
Okay, Robert Hartwig with the Insurance Information Institute, final comment on this part of our program. Do you think that is the trade-off? Has it been properly defined by Bruce Katz?
Yes, I do. I think that we've got a problem here whereby, quite frankly, we don't have a way. After major disasters, the government responds generally in an ad hoc fashion, not just with the actual response, apparently, but also in the way that it is financed. And there are mechanisms. It's time for everyone to sit down and think about how we can prevent the economic and human catastrophes that follow events like this. In a state like Florida, they've actually worked it out to a near science.
All right. We will come back to this subject many times in the near future. Thanks, all of you, for being with us. Robert Hartwig with the Insurance Information Institute, Bruce Katz, Vice President of Brookings, Alex Fraser with Standard & Poor's, and James O'Byrne, the editor of the Living Section of the Times-Picayune. Good luck particularly to you in getting yourself reestablished in New Orleans. Thanks again to all of you for being with us today. The New England Journal of Medicine has published what it calls an expression of concern about Merck & Company, which took the painkiller Vioxx off the market last year. The prestigious magazine says the data showing that Vioxx caused heart attacks was removed from a crucial study involving that drug. Merck says the results were fairly and accurately reported, but the story's bad news for a company that's facing some 6,500 lawsuits. In a moment, more about Merck's future on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Wormen Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Merck says it'll respond more completely to yesterday's editorial in the New England Journal of Medicine. In the meantime, the world's fifth largest pharmaceutical company has a lot of other problems. John Simons profiled Merck's challenges in this month's edition of Fortune magazine. John Simons, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
What are the principal things, other than the Vioxx issue, that are facing Merck?
Well, the first and sort of biggest issue for Merck is that for the last several years, probably the last half decade, their labs have not been very productive. And this is a problem across the drug industry. A lot of the sort of low-hanging fruit in terms of medical advances have been sort of picked already. And a lot of the more sort of difficult diseases are left to address. And Merck's labs have had a hard time coming up with new sort of big selling blockbuster drugs. So they face an even bigger problem, if you can believe it, than these Vioxx sort of lawsuits that they're facing. And that is in the actual business of making drugs.
When you say big-selling blockbuster drugs, Merck certainly has made plenty of them in the past, but I understand that some of the patents are running out. What will that mean to the revenue for the company?
That's right. Merck's biggest-selling drug is a cholesterol reduction medication called Zocor. And coming up this June 2006, the drug will go off patent, which means that generic makers will be able to come into the market, reproduce the drug, and of course sell it at a lower price. That effectively erases Merck's, the $5.2 billion in sales that Merck derives from that drug each year. So that's just completely, taken off of its income statement.
That's a huge hit.
Huge.
There is another drug as well, I understand, Fosamax, that's in that same category?
I think Fosamax is coming off patent later. I think it's maybe 2007 or 8.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, another, it's another big seller. So really, the people in the labs at Merck need to sort of put their heads down and come up with something big. And what makes this a really fascinating industry is that unlike other industries where you can sort of create a new product by adding more caffeine or putting more sugar into your soda or your latest version of a candy bar or whatever. This is like sort of art. It's like hoping that someone will create a masterpiece, and you just sort of hire all these great scientists and hope that they'll come up with something new and novel.
Interesting analogy. John Simons, again, is a writer for Fortune magazine, and we're talking about Merck. You report that the new CEO, Richard Clark, is expected to come up next week, I think, with something called the roadmap to try to help the company deal with these issues. What, in advance of his announcement, does it appear they're going to have to do?
Well, what ended up happening is that Mr. Clark's roadmap, a lot of people, including a lot of publications, including Fortune, started hearing rumors of what the roadmap included, and Merck went ahead and unveiled at least part of it. And we all knew that it would include quite a few job cuts. The company announced last week that it would cut about 7,000 workers in an initial phase of a restructuring. That's 11% of its workforce. It's a pretty deep cut.
Excuse me for interrupting you, but you're also saying that for the first time in the company's history, they're going to be narrowing the scope of research and development. What's the significance of that in terms of handling disease in this country and the rest of the world?
Yeah, it's a big issue. You know, Merck is one of the country's largest producers of vaccines, for instance, and vaccines haven't been really profitable, but they're a business that companies see themselves staying in because they want to, you know, it's for the public good, and something like that could be threatened. We don't know whether Merck will cut back on vaccines, but something like that could be really detrimental to the public good. So it's kind of unfortunate that Merck is caught in a situation where it really does need to cut.
All right. We'll try to keep track of what's happening at Merck and the other pharmaceutical companies as well as time goes on. John Simons, writer for Fortune magazine. Once again, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Producers of To the Point, Christian Bordahl, Francis Anderton, Katie Cooper, Ileana Justice, Jonah King, Sharon Rimbaum, managing producer Karen Radziner. Thanks also to the John Coltrane family. Our technical director is Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Warren Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.